Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 117 of the Gunblog Variety Cast, a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Aaron?
Well, I made it through the election without irreparable damage to my liver, so I call that a victory, although my sanity is always questionable. But I need cute things to get me through this week, so tell me something adorable about Dysis.
Well, so did you see the picture that I posted of Dysis getting her teeth brushed?
I did. It's so cute. She was sitting in the bathtub, and there's your little toothbrush, and she's like, ooh, toothpaste. Nom nom.
Yeah, she had to brush her teeth. You ever brush your dog's teeth?
Yeah, my mom and I, we brush our dog's teeth every night just to help prevent the cavities and things like that.
Every night? Wow. Ooh, that's a lot more often than I do. Well, see, Dysis actually has very clean teeth. We give her nice hard food to chew, so her teeth actually stay pretty clean.
Okay.
We don't brush her teeth for that.
Well, if you don't brush her teeth for that reason, then why do you do it at all?
Well, because her breath stinks. You remember the old commercial for Dentine? Brush your breath, brush your breath, brush your breath with Dentine. If Dysis had a commercial, it would be brush your breath with butthole. Yeah. It wouldn't be so bad, except that after she does it, she likes to spread the love. Want to taste what my butthole smells like? No, get it away.
Oh. Can you feel the love tonight?
So I don't know that that's adorable, but that's Dysis. So every once in a while, you're like, oh, dear Lord, here, would you like to get your teeth brushed? Brush your teeth. It's going to be so much fun. And Dysis goes and runs and jumps in the bathtub. And I break out the toothbrush and I brush the dog's teeth. She's pretty good about it. So she's a very nice dog. She'll let you trim her toenails with the Dremel. You brush her teeth. You get a little shedding blade and you can, you know, shed the dog. It's really nice. Very good dog. So there's your daily adorable.
You know, I have no good segue for this. So what the heck? We'll just bull our way through.
So on that note, Aaron, why don't we just head right into it?
Thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of the Gunblog Variety Cast. From Golden Saber to range rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
There you go, Anthony. That's exactly the kind of lead-in you wanted for your commercial, wasn't it? You go straight from Dysis to Lucky Gunner and Remington. Oh, yeah.
Well, we knew it had been building up for a while now, but now that the election is over, Beth finally grabs her soapbox and explains why she's proud she was named an enemy of Hillary Clinton.
You know, I've told myself time and time again that I was not going to get into a discussion about politics, and I was not going to talk about the election. But under the circumstances, with what has just happened, with Americans coming together and rallying together to make sure that Hillary Clinton did not get to the White House, I think I have to say something, especially as a female, as a mom, and as a gun owner. Now, I had a recent opportunity through the NRA America's First Freedom to have a chance to respond to the fact that Hillary Clinton named the NRA and its 5 million members as one of the enemies she is most proud of making over the years of her career. Does that sound insane to you? I know you've heard this before. She had the opportunity to name terrorist groups or to name pretty much any horrible, awful leader in the nation or in the world. And instead, she targeted 5 million responsible gun owners. I find that to be absolutely appalling. And I am not alone. I am not the only one who's been able to share a response to this. There's people like Natalie Foster, Carrie Lightfoot, Gabby Franco, Julie Golub. There are a lot of voices out there that had the opportunity to share what they thought about being named her number one enemy. Here's the thing, though. That whole idea came out of the quote from Franklin D. Roosevelt. He said, "I ask you to judge me by the enemies I have made." That is such an interesting concept for any of us. To think about our character, to think about who we are, to consider what we believe in and what other people think about us, we should look to our enemies. We should look to the people who are standing up against us, screaming at us, or writing about us, or slinging slurs or other things on Facebook and social media. We should look at the people who don't agree with us, who call us enemy instead of acquaintance or friend or coworker or whatever the case may be. And of course, it's interesting that in this line of work, if you haven't made some enemies, then you might not be doing it right, because people will disagree and they will stand against you. I'm proud that Hillary Clinton named me as an enemy and that I can supposedly count her as an enemy of mine, because I hope that says a lot about who I am and about my character. Most people have described her as dishonest. They do not believe her. She is not qualified. She's extremely careless. It was President Obama who even said that Hillary Clinton will say anything and change nothing. This is a woman who has basically told us that we have no right to bear arms, and even further than that, that children, even the day, the minute they are supposed to be born into this world, have no constitutional rights. This is a woman who has stood by a husband who is known to have raped women, and she has belittled them, berated them, and in some cases, done horrible things beyond that, legally. It just floors me. It absolutely floors me the things this woman was capable of doing beyond just what the FBI was investigating. And again, I am proud to say that I am her enemy. If anything, that says more about me, because I know who I am. I know what I stand for. I know that I believe in our Constitution and in the democratic republic that our nation has been founded on. I know that I want our country to come together. We need to come together, and especially females, moms, and gun owners. We need to celebrate the fact that Hillary Clinton was kept out of office, and that hopefully from this point on, we have a chance to make a difference. I know I'm getting all over the place and standing on a pedestal, and that's not my usual thing, but I felt like I had to say something. Thankfully, I can also say that until next time, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the Donate or Subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Police use tear gas, robot, to end 9-hour standoff in Greensboro. Dateline Greensboro, North Carolina. A man who shot at police with an assault rifle during a 9-hour standoff with officers has been arrested, Greensboro police said Saturday morning.
Assault rifle? So he was shooting at them with an automatic weapon that shot anywhere from 3-round bursts to full automatic magazine emptying ammo dumps?
Yeah, probably not. Layers and layers of editorial oversight, I'm sure. Police arrested suspect around 10 a.m. at the Carolina Woods Apartments off Highway 29. Police say he was wanted on multiple charges, including attempted murder for a shooting that happened at High Point back in September. About 60 people were evacuated from the apartment complex while the standoff went down. Police allowed them back in their homes once suspect was arrested. Greensboro police say detectives found suspect shortly before midnight on Friday at the apartment complex. Detectives tried to arrest suspect, and that's when they say he pointed a gun at officers and barricaded himself in a ground floor apartment. Police say suspect fired his gun at officers at least 3 times, and officers shot back twice. No officers were hurt in the gunfire. Police say they also used tear gas about 24 times to try to get suspect out of the apartment. Officers then used a robot to get inside the home. When the robot became disabled, officers went inside and found suspect hiding in a room in the back of the apartment. Suspect was taken to a local hospital for the treatment of minor wounds and to determine if he was shot, according to police.
I'm actually disappointed that it was tear gas and a robot and not a tear gas robot, because that just sounds awesome.
That would be much more interesting, I think. So what kind of person do you figure takes tear gas a dozen times, plus a robot that he managed to disable, I guess, and shot at the cops at least three times, and they shot at him, and he might be injured?
A rogue radio-controlled enthusiast with a really, really bad case of allergies who needed his sinuses cleared?
Well, possibly. Or it could have been DWI level 4, misdemeanor, non-class code. 3 counts, possessed schedule 2, felon class I. Possession of a firearm by a felon, felon class G. Assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, attempted, felon class F. And assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, felon class C.
Well, that's certainly a mouthful.
Yeah. You know what we call that in any other state? That would be called attempted murder.
But was the robot okay? That's what I want to know.
Unfortunately, there's no information on that, but you go, Johnny Five. I just dated myself, didn't I?
No kill, Johnny Five!
No disassemble!
No disassemble!
What happens when you run a denial of service attack against traditional infrastructure? Baron tells us about a teen who wrote a script that caused iPhones to do just that. In?
Tech tips. Tech tips. Tech tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech tips with the Baron.
Well, hey, Baron, what's new in the world of tech this week?
Previously, we talked about denial of service attacks on the internet. People forget similar things can be employed against more traditional infrastructure. In this case, 911.
Ooh, that sounds really bad.
So, here's what happened. I don't remember if I talked about it previously on the podcast, but some research was done, and it was estimated about 6,000 smartphones could take down an entire state. 200,000 infected phones could bring down the entire country. The way this would work is just to overload the switches handling the incoming calls. You could filter them out after the first call, but you would risk tagging a legitimate hang-up call as being false. If you're interested in the research paper, it's in the show notes.
Okay, so somebody writes a research paper, so what?
The thing is, some jerk, because I'm not going to name the kid, wrote an exploit for iOS. This exploit was executed by following a link which would run a script and cause the device to call 911 and hang up immediately. In other words, he took the research paper and brought it into the real world. He published the link on his Twitter, hitting up over 12,000 followers, of which 1,849 people tapped the link.
Okay, nobody does this without a reason. How was he getting paid?
So, Little Miss Idiot here claims he published the wrong link and it was just supposed to reboot the device after displaying a pop-up. I call bull****. If he had an exploit like this, Apple has a bug bounty and would have paid him handsomely for it. He could have sold it to someone else and made money as well. Instead, he just wanted to watch the world burn.
So he was doing it for the lulz?
Yep, he thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Kid was so hot, he got busted. This is also why if you have an iOS device, you saw an OS update just earlier last week. So, remember kids, don't click random links, don't trust people unless you have a reason to, and lastly, remember the story from The Dark Knight.
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing them away.
So why steal them?
Well, because he thought it was good sport. Because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
When someone brings up a vulnerability, pay attention. Never ask why someone would want to do that, because in reality, some people just want to watch the world burn.
All right, Baron. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
The main topic segment. Well, Aaron, the election's over. And the NRA endorsed candidate one. So, no matter that he was not my first choice, he now owes us gun owners big time. Maybe we should think about what we as gun owners should be pushing for as our reward for the loyalty that we showed him.
Wasn't that the topic of Michael Bayne's podcast on Thursday? Like, his entire podcast? And I'm pretty sure every other podcast is going to be doing the same thing. How about we talk about the Electoral College instead?
The Electoral College, Aaron? Seriously?
Yeah, Every time there's a difference between electoral and popular vote results, we get the inevitable do away with the Electoral College arguments.
Okay, so what?
So why don't we do it like Weird does with his segment and have a discussion of the various arguments for the Electoral College? That way, our listeners are well-informed and can properly discuss it when it's inevitably brought up by the Hillary supporters.
Well, actually, that's not a bad idea, Aaron. So for those who are my age who slept through civics, or for those millennials who got current events or some crap like that instead, how does the Electoral College work?
In our election system, a candidate must receive at least 270 Electoral College votes in order to win. Now, these electoral votes are not divided evenly by state, but rather by representation in Congress. For example, New York elects 27 members to join the House of Representatives and, of course, 2 to join the Senate. Therefore, it gets 29 Electoral College votes. Nevada, meanwhile, because it has a smaller population, has 4 representatives and, of course, 2 senators, so it gets 6 Electoral College votes. And in our current system, whoever wins the most votes in a state wins all of the state's electors.
So what's the problem if we just went with a popular vote?
Well, if we went to a pure popular vote system, we would run into the same problem that pure democracies have over representative republics, the tyranny of the majority over the minority. And there's a picture in the show notes that illustrates how half or more of the United States population lives in just a handful of super dense counties. If you don't live there, under a pure popular vote system, your vote doesn't matter at all. As an example, farmers don't want to be at the mercy of city voters, who might decide that using water to fill their swimming pools is more important than irrigating crops.
Oh, you mean kind of like what's going on to the farmers in Sacramento area in Northern California?
Yeah, exactly. Now imagine that on a nationwide level. Another feature of the Electoral College is that it promotes a broad two-party system. Now, many people think that two-party systems are bad, but consider the alternatives. Do you want 3 or 4 parties with minor parties dragging major parties away from the political center? Currently, we have a center-seeking system with politics, as they say, played between the 40-yard lines. With fringe parties that need to be compensated for their support, you end up with a much more polarized political environment. And do we really want more of that? Then we need to consider the idea of regional parties. What would happen if the New England states decided to field a political party based upon the idea of high road tolls, low heating oil costs, and free Amtrak for everyone? Now, that might be popular up in Yankee land. If they didn't have to worry about how that would play down here in the South, they might be tempted to split off from the main party and field their own candidates and try to force the rest of us to pay for their favored policies just to make a majority in the House and Senate.
Currently, political candidates focus on so-called swing states and ignore some of the big, reliable states. Isn't that a problem?
Swing states, which are also called battleground states, are states which do not reliably go to a particular party. And because these are winner-take-all states, it's important for candidates to focus on those states to get all of their votes. This is why, for example, Florida is important, as it's a very purple state, whereas candidates rarely campaign in California because that state is reliably Democrat. So if you think swing states are important now, under popular vote, the candidates would just focus on states with large cities like California, New York, Illinois, Texas, Pennsylvania, and still Florida.
And wouldn't it be easier to get out the vote in those states? They have all the major television stations.
Oh yeah, you've got all the city-based infrastructure, all the media, as opposed to going out to the boondocks to find out what a voter in a very rural county wants.
And didn't Andrew Branca say something about this on Facebook on, you know, popular vote versus Electoral College vote? I forget what it was, but he used some kind of analogy.
Indeed, he did. He compared winning the popular vote to yards gained in a football game. Quoting, "The winner of a football game is not the team that has the most yards gained. It's the team that scores the most points. Any team that maximizes yards gained at the cost of points scored should anticipate losing." And that's what's going on here. It doesn't really matter if you win the popular vote. You're just gaining yards. No, you have to score points.
So you're saying that even though people think that popular vote is more fair than electoral vote, it's really not.
Absolutely. In fact, if anything, it's even more unfair because it centralizes all the voting power in the cities. If you're worried about flyover country now, when we go to the popular vote, flyover country becomes irrelevant.
Ugh. Are there any other options available besides winner-take-all electoral college voting?
Yes. While 48 states are winner-take-all, Maine and Nebraska use the congressional district method. And the way that works is that instead of the electors being distributed based on the popular vote of the entire state, they're distributed based on the popular vote of the state's individual districts. Maine is worth 4 electoral college votes, and there are 2 congressional districts in the state. Winning the popular vote in a district will earn a candidate 1 elector. Plus, they get a bonus of 2 points if they win the statewide popular vote. It's therefore possible for the electoral college votes to be split, i.e. both candidates get some of them.
Oh, see, now that makes sense. I was wondering how you could get, like, either 4 or 3-1 out of Maine. I was looking at that, and I just couldn't understand it. So that's how that works?
That's how that works. Now, in my opinion, the congressional district method seems to be a fair compromise between popular vote and electoral vote for these reasons. 1, it's more easily implemented, as each state can do it via state legislature, rather than having to nationally dismantle the Electoral College, which would require a constitutional amendment. 2, it actually makes your vote worth more in a state that would traditionally go the other way, such as voting Republican in California. If you have a red district in that state, you could actually offer up an electoral vote. And finally, swing states would become less relevant, as candidates would have less to gain by winning that state, and instead could focus on a tactic of scoring many more districts across the country, some even in normally safe states. For example, while most of Texas is red, Austin is very, very blue. So that's the short course on the Electoral College. The next time someone complains about it, educate them and encourage them to campaign for their state to switch to the congressional district method instead.
Well, there you go, folks. Some good information. You can use that the next time somebody tells you that we need to go to a pure popular vote. And thanks, Aaron. Now at least we won't be like every other gun podcast out there telling everybody all the things that we need to go ask Donald Trump for. So, good choice.
Speaking of the election, many fissures have emerged between friends and family members during this contentious election. Even Tiffany has had her social alliances tested. She gives us tips on how your cherished relationships and your cherished political beliefs can coexist.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Until you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
Hey guys, what's going on? It's Tiffany here. And the first thing I want to do before I forget this week is to send a great big thank you to all the wonderful people out there who donated to Gunblog Variety Cast. And those donations helped to supply little old me with a lot of cool new equipment so that I can do more interviews and record people remotely through the phone and also in person. And I am super excited about it. I got a whole pile of stuff here that I'm still unpackaging and plugging in and testing out and all that jazz. So I am looking forward to diving in with all that new stuff. So kudos to everybody who listened and who pitched in, even if you only pitched in $1. It's really going to good use, and I appreciate Sean and Aaron entrusting me with this somewhat intimidating task of interviewing more folks, but it should be fun. I'm looking forward to it. So once again, thank you, thank you, thank you. But I don't have an interview this week because there's so much other stuff going on, and I probably would have had trouble talking somebody into being recorded having a chat with me this week anyway because everybody's in a crappy mood. That's what happens when you come off the tail end of a really contentious election, which, unless you've been under a rock for the last 18 months, you know that's exactly what the United States of America has just done. So I thought I would spend this week talking about a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and that is how to keep your friends in spite of your political disagreements. How to have both friends and political convictions at the same time, even when they are like oil and water. So I've got a few quick tips that I want to lay on you guys, and hopefully one or two of them will come in handy one day.
Number one.
First and foremost, if you are in the midst of a grave national period of mourning, a collective sense of emotional crisis, I'm talking like on the precipice, something really traumatic has just happened that affects large swaths of people. That doesn't necessarily mean it affects you, but you know, and you are bearing witness to the fact that it truly affects a great number of people. Here's the first thing you need to do. Please stay the fuck off of social media. Shut it down. Shut it down. Speaking as someone who honestly just logged out of Facebook in the past 24 hours on all her devices for the first time in maybe 8 or 9 years, I guarantee you it will save you a ton of grief, and it will save any number of people who are friends with you on social media a great deal of grief. Here's why. Everybody's emotions are running high, and it is unbelievably easy to say stuff on social media in the heat of the moment. Most of the stuff that I see posted online might not be quite as readily uttered, or at least won't be as carelessly uttered, if it has to be said while looking at a person in that person's face. So if you really, really have that big of a need to pontificate, to narrate, to commentate in the wake of a huge national event, if your voice is that important that the whole world must hear from you on a public stage in the moments and hours after something really traumatic affects the whole nation, then you need to pick up the telephone and call people individually. If it's not worth a phone call, or if it's not worth arranging to say over a cup of coffee while looking at someone in the face, then it's not worth plastering all over Facebook. At least not in the 6 hours after this drastic event has happened, right? This is true whether it is a historic election being decided in an unanticipated way, or the horrific murder of 5 police officers through a brutal, cowardly ambush, right? Stuff like that hits people really close to home. And the last thing you want to do is pop off at the mouth 22 minutes later in a forum that will forever be imprinted on the public cyber stage, even if you turn around and delete your post or what have you. You have no idea who's seeing this stuff. You have no idea how it's going to be taken, right? A lot of times what people are saying is perfectly innocuous. And that would be clear if it were being said in person, because when you communicate with people in person, then those folks, while receiving your message, they have the benefit of body language, of facial expressions, of hand gestures, of all of the nonverbal communication that helps us to interpret the words that are coming out of people's mouths. We are robbed of all of those indicators when we are reduced to a mere two-dimensional reading, a rendition of what it is that you're trying to convey. You especially don't want to take that risk when the entire country is about to erupt in, you know, just total emotional meltdown, right? If we're within 24 hours of something happening that some people see as catastrophic, okay? You may not see it as catastrophic, but surely you have the humanity, you know, the level of empathy to understand, even if you disagree wholeheartedly, you understand what it's like to feel like you've been hit in the gut with a brick. So if you know that folks feel that way, keep that in mind before posting that joke or that meme or that little quip or whatever it is that you want to just pop on Facebook, because we're all in a perpetual contest to see how many people like what I have to say, or how many comments can I get, or how long does it take before my really witty post goes viral. Or, you know, I think when we have really historic events that happen on the national stage, they are apparent to everybody who's paying attention, and we really don't need the captions, from armchair commentators or what have you. So that's not to say that no one out there has anything worthwhile to say. I'm sure many of us do. But just in those few moments and hours right after someone is hit in the gut with a brick, you want to either talk to that person one-on-one while you can look them in the eye, or you want to just hold off and be patient and understand that, you know, the world will continue turning even if you don't rush to post your super, super informative, witty, genius Facebook post. Okay? All right.
Number two.
Next, my suggestion is to simply listen. I know that sounds way oversimplistic, but it's something that people often forget to do and don't realize that they're not doing it. As you're talking, which of course I'm doing right now, which is ironic, but the more you talk, the less you're listening. And that's true whether in oral form or in written form, which is another reason why it's not a good idea to go writing dissertations on Facebook in the middle of an adrenaline dump, right? Whether that adrenaline is fueled by grief or by jubilation. Okay. We all learn in our training that your skills diminish by a certain percentage the more stressed you are. And stress comes in many forms, one of which is feeling like you've just been hit in the gut with a brick or getting the most unexpected happy surprise of your life, or at least your political memory, right? Both of those are levels of psychological stress, and they don't present ideal opportunities for you to spout your most rational thoughts, okay? So a much smarter way to comport oneself in these situations is to simply listen. You'd be surprised how much you might learn about folks you thought you were at odds with. So, for example, one of the most prevalent criticisms of Hillary Clinton was that she's too rehearsed, she's too robotic, she's not relatable, not human enough. That's a completely fair, totally fair critique, right? One of the biggest critiques of Donald Trump is that he is completely unfiltered. He does not have anything between his brain and his mouth. That too is probably a legitimate critique. So the moral of that story is, shocker. Each of those candidates probably could have stood to learn a little bit from the other one. And the only way you do that is by listening. Here's what happened when late night comic Seth Meyers actually listened to people with whom he disagreed.
I felt a lot of emotions last night and into today, some sadness, some anger, some fear. But I'm also aware that those are the same emotions a lot of Trump supporters felt, emotions that led them to make their choice, and it would be wrong for me to think my emotions are somehow more authentic than their emotions. We're always better as a society when we have empathy for one another, so I would just say, I would like to say to those Trump voters, congratulations. I sincerely hope he addresses your concerns. I sincerely hope that if you felt forgotten, he won't forget you now.
So even though I detect a little bit of passive aggression in his voice, a little bit of incredulous hesitation about trusting Donald Trump, I do commend Seth Meyers for at least being man enough to say that on national TV the day after an election that clearly was decided in a way that was not his first preference. So I hope that more people will approach this election in that way.
Number three.
First of all, I have to say that the countdown dude is a little bit creepy. I'm having second thoughts about that sound effect. But alas, we're at our third suggestion. It's a fun one. Create buffer zones for yourself. Find something that you can do that has absolutely nothing to do with politics, especially now that the election is over. Instead of obsessing over your Facebook feed, turn off the news, turn off the computer. Go catch a movie. Go have a conversation with your kid. Go watch a game. Watch sports. Do something besides dwell on politics. Trust me, I guarantee you the presidency will be there when you come back. So you're not holding up anything. you're not the one sort of making sure that all the wheels keep turning in the presidential transition period. So don't worry about it. They'll be okay. They got it under control. You can step away now. Get back to your life. Go do something totally fun with your friends. Remember, this segment is about preserving relationships. So instead of getting into a debate with that homeboy about politics, grab him up and go catch a movie or go get something to eat. Go to your favorite restaurant, go get a beer or whatever. The other day I went to see Doctor Strange because I'm a total Avengers and Marvel freak. Although I wasn't really into the comics, so somebody will have to fill me in on the comics, but I love the movies. And Doctor Strange is like the Avengers with LSD or something, I think. Is LSD the one where you have those weird hallucinations, or am I mixing up my illicit drugs? I don't know. But at any rate, go see Doctor Strange, and if you can, see it in 3D, because it's one of those movies that's actually kind of cool to see in 3D, as opposed to a movie that they made for 2D and then they later just slapped it on a 3D screen so they can charge you a little bit more and say that they're creative and high tech or whatever. Go see a really good movie, or go read, or, you know, listen to a podcast that's not about politics.
Number four.
Here's an important one. Be careful about race. Race is just one of those topics that's it's just difficult to navigate, you know? It's just tough. There are deep reservoirs of emotions that are raw and authentic and legitimate, but that unfortunately defy clear articulation. And I know that that sounds like a cop-out, but there is a finite number of words in the English language. So they can never be enough to fully express every emotion. That's why we have things like art and music, because they're much better at communicating than words are, because words are finite. But race is one of those topics. You can't, I struggle to convey my own thoughts on race, even though it's something that, you know, it's something that just sort of plays in the background of my mind all the time. I got to tell you, you know, race was a factor here in these last few months. And again, I'm going to keep throwing this caveat in there, rightly or wrongly. I'm the first person to admit that there were a lot of instances where people injected race into the election when it was probably irrelevant. I would also submit to you that there were times when race came up and it was actually a real factor, and people who objected to what appeared to be at the very least a lack of fluency on the part of the candidates on the issue of race were, in my opinion, justified in doing so. So, for example, when you say to an entire race of people, "You have nothing to lose," that's a serious affront. It's kind of a slap in the face. And I suspect that when people say things like that, they don't mean it literally. But race is one of those turfs where, unfortunately, and I do think that this is unfortunate, the slightest misstatement can go horribly awry. Any unfortunate turn of a phrase that would be easily forgiven in any other context is naturally amplified if the context is race. And so if you are of one of the racial groups that had occasion to take offense to some of the things that either Donald Trump said or that Hillary Clinton said, try to, again, observe the dignity of silence first, be slow to react. Try to exercise some level of empathy. Try to give the benefit of the doubt that people have genuinely benevolent intentions, usually, that they just have trouble communicating in a way that is as innocent as their intentions are. In other words, don't be so quick to accuse somebody of being a racist. Like, it's not that most of the time. There are racists out there. Trust me. Which leads me to the converse. If you're one of those people that's really, really quick to just kind of brush off, wave off, dismiss any complaints about the campaign that are grounded in race, be careful about that too, okay? Because there's just something about the nation's first Black president being immediately followed by someone who was endorsed not only by individuals like David Duke, but by the actual Ku Klux Klan itself, the institution. That's something that cuts marrow deep. And it's not Donald Trump's fault. He didn't ask for that endorsement. But it's still something that just, it's just, there's something kind of salt in the wound about that. And people are feeling it at levels and depths that they may not even fully appreciate themselves. And so because of that, because that's kind of simmering beneath the surface, any remote toe in the water of race is going to be explosive. I don't say that to tell everybody to walk on eggshells or to be afraid of the topic. I do think race is a worthy topic, and we all need to start feeling more comfortable talking about it. But I just ask that you be careful about your tone. Be careful about being too hasty with how you word things, because I don't mean to be too simplistic, but think of it as a cost-benefit analysis. You know, are the benefits of what you were about to say worth the costs that could be paid in hurt and emotions, even if those emotions are based on misunderstanding, right? Those phrase could potentially be irreparable. So just keep that in mind when you work up the courage to kind of wade into the race waters, all right? Those of you who are willing to do it, I commend you. It's a very, very impossibly difficult topic, but it has to be faced. It has to be addressed. I guess this segment isn't nearly long enough to to cover that in anywhere near the level of detail that it probably needs to be covered. So I apologize for not even scratching the surface in any worthwhile manner, but I hope that little reminder will stick with you as you engage in dialogue with different people, different cultures, folks from different backgrounds in the wake of this historic election. It's just something that we all need to keep in mind, no matter what race you are.
Number five.
Phew. Okay, so we got the hard one out of the way. And with that, I will just leave you with maybe some of the best advice that you could get on how to keep your friends in spite of political differences. And that advice comes from the candidates themselves, who I was pleased to see gave some happy, positive, and encouraging words of wisdom after the election was decided.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time.
So if you just completely fell out with your buddy who is a Hillary supporter, yank that little clip from the Hillary speech and maybe leave it on their voicemail. And if you fell out with your buddy who's a Trump supporter, then maybe you can, you know, yank that part from the Trump speech. And to the extent possible, mend wounds. Everything's over. The world's still going. The sun's still coming up. It's going to be all good. We're all family. So with that, put a smile on your face, go find a good movie to watch, listen to a good song, have a happy week, and I will talk to you guys later. Stay safe, keep it centered and even.
You can follow Tiffany at frontsightpress.com.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette!
So I've been hearing reports of protests and road blockages as a result of the election, and so because it's timely, and because I'm fighting a headache right now, I'm going to paraphrase from Wednesday's Blue Collar Prepping article titled, Driving Home During Urban Unrest. So first, have a plan. Even if you've lived in an area for years, during the stress of the moment, you might not remember the best way to get back home. To avoid that, develop a plan beforehand, so instead of thinking of what to do next, you can quickly implement your solution. Of course, this plan is going to vary based on your location, time of day, and the type of unrest you're trying to avoid, so instead of having a fixed plan, you need to have multiple solutions available. As an example, the author of the article, who lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, has this as his plan. I have a working radio in my truck, and the two all-new stations are already programmed. My smartphone has a map app that is very good with real-time traffic overlays available. I don't need a paper map, but I have the four needed to plot the way home if everything else fails. If the worst happens while I'm at work, earthquake or riots, I have enough friends to put me up. If there are problems after I leave, I may not have the luxury of getting off the freeway safely or at all. Second, work the plan. Now that you have your routes home, drive them at different times during your days off. You'll eliminate some of them for having too many lights, or for being under construction, or for being routes everyone else will try to take, or any number of other reasons. Third, don't be afraid to throw the plan away. As a pilot friend of the author once said, don't let your ego get you in trouble. If you know there is weather in front of you, don't expect to get lucky and find a way through or around the storm. Some days, you'll just have to abandon your original objective, turn around, and go home, so make sure you know where highway exits are. Also, understand that sometimes the best way out of a situation isn't to go through it or try to outrun it, but rather to go completely perpendicular to it and wait for it to blow over. A good example of this is seeking refuge at a nearby friend's house and weathering the situation from a bugged-in perspective. It's far better to spend the night on a couch than to try to turn around, get stuck, and then get caught in the unrest you were trying to avoid. Finally, plan for failure. Realize that sometimes you're going to get caught up in things despite your best efforts. In situations like this, your best bet is to have a well-stocked get-home bag and to remember the following points if confronted with a mob. 1. Keep moving slowly and do not stop. 2. If blocked in, do not exit your vehicle. And 3. If attacked, use the minimum amount of force to protect yourself and anyone else in your vehicle. For more information, check out the Blue Collar Prepping segment Roadblocked on episode 100 of the Gunblog Variety Cast.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. The League of Women Voters in Bloomington, Minnesota had a debate on gun control. The arguments made by Protect Minnesota were so anti-gun nutty that it just begged for a patented weird audio fisk. In This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
At the end of October, the League of Women Voters in Bloomington, Minnesota held a debate on gun regulation. On the dais were friends of the show Sarah Cade and Brian Strasser, as well as gun control advocates Police Chief Paul Schnell and the Reverend Nancy Nord-Bentz of Protect Minnesota. Again, this is This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery, so I'm only going to focus on the anti-gun voices. Sarah and Brian did an amazing job, and check out the show notes to watch the whole debate. I think it'll be well worth your time. So this week I'm going to focus on Reverend Nancy Nord-Bentz of Protect Minnesota. You'll soon see why. Brian Strasser of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus did a great job, but he left some avenues for me to add to his rebuttals. Number one, anti-gunners don't listen to podcasts, so I can consider this a friendly crowd. My job here is to entertain and educate you, not persuade you. Brian was talking to a mixed crowd, so a different tactic than what I take here was warranted. Number two, well, let's just start the fisk and you'll see what number two is.
The American gun homicide rate is 25 times higher, and our gun suicide rate is 28 times higher than other Western democracies. Guns kill more Americans every year than AIDS, drug overdoses, wars, and terrorism combined. This year, guns will kill more Americans than motor vehicle accidents.
Wow! I can't blame Brian for leaving me some meat to work with here. He only had a limited amount of time to give his rebuttals. He simply didn't have the time to pick apart every single one of her blatant lies. Hell, I don't even have the time to do it here in this podcast. But how many hearts and minds are you going to win when your rebuttal is, everything, and I mean everything my opponent just said was a blatant and demonstrable lie? We've gone over the cherry-picked and racist developed nation crap, as well as the fallacy that is gun violence and gun suicide, when you should talk all violence and suicide if you're talking about public safety. She also parroted the point we quoted from Vox Media back in episode 81. If you missed it, her stat about drug overdoses, AIDS, war, and terrorism deaths surpassing gun deaths is blatantly false. Drug overdoses alone kill more people than gun violence. And while the other factors are indeed less than our national gun homicide rate, that isn't true when you combine them, as she claims. And no, guns won't kill more people than cars. There have been a few select states where it has been projected that guns will kill more people than cars, but it is yet to have happened, and certainly hasn't happened on a national level. So yeah, all lies.
The CDC was one of the first agencies to study gun violence as a public health issue. In 1993, its Center for Injury Prevention published a study that showed the presence of a gun in the home substantially increased the risk of gun-related death and suicide. When that study came out, the NRA went a little ballistic and began pressuring members of Congress to stop CDC's gun research.
So first, let's look at the big picture here. She's talking about the Center for Disease Control, looking at gun violence. What disease causes gun violence? Asking the CDC to look into gun violence is like asking the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to design a Mars lander. It just doesn't make any sense. So now on to the details. The study she's quoting, as you might have guessed, was the famous Arthur Kellerman study we've talked about so much on this show. If you're new here, the Kellerman study claimed that if you kept a gun in your home, you were vastly more likely to be killed than defend yourself with one. To show this, Kellerman first started with a very limited sample size. A person only successfully defended their life when they killed an attacker. Oh, and all violence on both sides needed to happen at a home, not in public. And the biggest issue was there were no controls for if the gun was legally owned for legal purposes versus a gun owned by a violent criminal for violent criminal enterprises. Dr. Kellerman also didn't control if the victim actually owned the gun. So if the murderer's gun was recovered at the scene, that was counted against the victim. So yeah, if you fund a turd like that with public monies, we're going to cut your funding. Before you wring your hands too much, the FBI, BATFE, state and local law enforcement can still research gun violence. And they do, just not the CDC, because that's not their damn job.
I'd like to begin by acknowledging that the 1994 federal assault weapons ban that expired in 2004 had so many loopholes that gun manufacturers were able to get around it really easily.
Quick note, loophole is being defined as people complying with laws in ways we don't like. So gun manufacturers found no such loopholes. They simply complied with the law, and anti-gunners got pissed that they didn't just close up shop and stop making guns. I'll also note that the Reverend Bence doesn't acknowledge the current fiasco in Massachusetts, where Attorney General Mara Healey claims that the assault feature list that makes up the bulk of the bill was meaningless, but instead gives her blessing to a new assault weapons ban that has a different version of the features list. When somebody makes a law banning gun features and gets pissed when gun makers comply by removing the named features, these people are nuts.
Right now, federal law prohibits hunters from having more than 3 shells in their shotguns when shooting ducks, but doesn't limit the size of magazines on guns that shoot people.
Game laws are written to preserve the stock of wild animals for future generations. Is she saying you need a limited number of bullets to shoot violent criminals? Is she saying she wants to preserve violent criminals for future generations? I think she is. If you look at crime statistics in the wake of gun control legislation, yeah.
The bill specifically exempts traditional firearms that are manually operated by bolt, pump, lever, or side action. Basically, all sport rifles and shotguns.
All sport guns, unless you're one of the millions of people who hunt and shoot with modern sporting rifles. Also, since when was the Second Amendment about ducks and deer? If I'm going to defend my life or the lives of my family and friends, I'm not going to give the bastard threatening us a sporting chance, thank you. She really does want us to preserve violent criminals for future generations.
Saying a semi-automatic assault weapon with a large capacity magazine is no different from a hunting rifle is like saying a tank is no different from a Honda Civic. Like tanks, semi-automatic assault weapons are weapons of war designed for the express and exclusive purpose of killing human beings with great speed and efficiency.
Just amazing. But it goes on.
The assault weapons that would be banned by H.R. 4269 have 2 to 3 times the muzzle velocity of other guns. Bullets fired from these weapons hit their targets at much greater speed, causing far more serious injuries. Instead of breaking a bone, they shatter a bone and neighboring bones as well. Instead of slicing through intestines, in the words of a trauma surgeon, they literally cause intestines to explode. The assault weapons that would be banned can shoot as fast as the shooter can pull the trigger, up to 45 rounds per minute. They are outfitted like military weapons with pistol grips, thumb hole or butthole stocks, I think he said, and barrel shrouds to make them easier to control during rapid firing. As mentioned earlier, they are designed to hold large capacity magazines, devices also banned by the bill, that can hold up to 100 rounds of ammunition.
Is she insane? All this muzzle velocity and terminal ballistics talk is crap. First, she's wanting to ban AR-15s, not .223 ammo. That round is going the exact same speed, if not faster, out of a safe bolt action as it is out of an evil black AR. Second, as a general rule, bolt-action hunting calibers are much more powerful than intermediate calibers used in so-called assault weapons. She's also saying that making a gun easier to control is somehow a bad thing? What alternative does she want? A gun that hits anything but what you're aiming at? This is what we get when we allow people who know absolutely nothing about firearms to write firearms law.
A police captain from Brockton, Massachusetts, described it in these words. We are literally outgunned. You're talking about the kind of firepower that can go through vehicles, through vests, that can literally go through a house.
Of course, Massachusetts has an assault weapons ban in place, so the solution is more assault weapons bans? Anybody who's done some backyard ballistics tests will know that virtually any centerfire handgun is capable of firing through a car. They really don't slow bullets down much. Police vests are only rated to stop handgun and shotgun rounds, so any centerfire rifle will compromise a vest. And houses don't slow bullets down much either. Though 5.56 has shown to have considerably less building material penetration than handgun or shotgun rounds, so that's a complete lie too. Last, they turn their attention to the terror watch list.
There are 30 to 40 million other American citizens who are prohibited from buying guns. Mainly felons, but not all. And no one in these groups gets the kid glove treatment from the government. If you're a member of a prohibited purchasers group, your right to purchase a gun is prohibited, even if your crime is in the past and you've paid your debt to society. The NRA bill would assure special treatment for one protected group, suspected terrorists.
I'll let Brian Strasser finish this one off because I really couldn't have said it any better.
Nancy made a reference to, this is a special due process provision, and I don't agree with that characterization. We have millions of people that are prohibited from owning a firearm, that are in the FBI system that is used in the federal background check process. These people have had due process. They have been convicted of a felony. They have been convicted of misdemeanor domestic abuse. They have been convicted of domestic abuse involving a weapon or violence. They have been adjudicated by a judge in a process with representation that they are violently, dangerously, mentally ill, or chemically dependent, or one of a host of other prohibitions that are in the federal law and in the state laws that govern these issues. They have had due process. This is a government official putting you on a list.
Well said, Brian. You really did good out there. Keep up the good fight.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week. A real quick plug of the week for the Signal messaging app. Aaron, do you text with people much?
Oh, all the time.
Have you ever wondered what would happen if somebody decided to maybe social engineer their way into your Facebook account and then start looking through all your private messages?
No, because they'd find a lot of annoying stuff about My Little Pony.
You never talk about anything private in your private messages, in your Facebook messages? Things that maybe you wouldn't want people to know about?
For sake of argument, let's say I have sent a questionable picture now and then.
A questionable picture now and then? Ooh, now I want to hack your Facebook. So everybody, facebook.com/AaronPaulette. What was your birthday again? So after you've done all the obvious things like use two-factor authentication and use a complex password, hopefully using a password manager so that your passwords are not words and the simple, easy to guess passwords and
like
simple
password
changes like password and 1234 and stupid crap like that. A way to make sure that your messages are completely private is to use something like Signal, which is a messaging app by Whisper Systems. It's secure. It's based on a device that you happen to be using rather than something that you can log into on a website from any computer. So what you do is you download an app to your, say, your smartphone. It uses your phone number and then it uses your contacts in your phone to find other Signal users so that you can then talk to them. You can't log into this by using another device. Somebody else can't just figure out your password and then log in from another computer somewhere and then read your messages. If you want to be able to use Signal on your desktop, you add it to Chrome as like an app on Chrome. When you open it up in Chrome, it's going to show you one of those QR codes. You then scan with your phone and you tell it this is an acceptable computer to use. It's telling the application that this computer is good, that this browser here is okay. Not that you can log in anywhere. No, just that this browser is okay. So if you go change computers, you can't use Signal over there. You have to do it all again. So somebody can't come in somewhere else and then just hack their way into your private messages. So if you happen to be sending those questionable pictures that you don't want other people to, say, find, or if you just don't want people to be able to hack into your Facebook and read your stuff, then this is the messaging app for you. So check it out, whispersystems.org. The app is called Signal.
And I've already downloaded it on my phone, so no one is going to be able to find those questionable pictures of Richard Nixon that I sent to people.
Oh, yes. Okay, I'm changing that. I'm not hacking into your Facebook again. That's right there. That's mean, Aaron. That's like, that's awful. You would do that to people, wouldn't you? That's hunting over bait.
We all have different ways of sending dick pics.
It's true. Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that the Gunblog Variety Cast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode117.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you.
And can properly discuss it when it's inevitably brought up by the Hillary supporters.
Oh, well, that's actually not a bad idea, Aaron. Mm. Well, actually, that's not a bad idea, Aaron. Damn it. Idea? Where the f*** am I from? Well, actually, that's not a bad idea, Aaron.
This is a URS production.